We're going to read God's word together. We're going to read, first of all, from Matthew chapter 13. And if you want to follow in one of these wonderful things, Bibles, it's page 999, or it's all here on the screen, which is great. And I'm going to read it from the screen because my eyes are dimming as I grow older, and this is much easier. So Matthew chapter 13, first of all, verses 44 to 46. This is Jesus speaking. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. And when a man found it, he hid it again. And then in his joy, he went and sold all he had and bought that field. And again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. And when he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. And then I want us to go from there, the words of Jesus recorded in the Gospel of Matthew, to the words of St. Paul, a follower of Jesus, writing to the church in Corinth. And we're going to read from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and see if I can find it here, hang on, where's it gone? There we go. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and we're going to begin to read at verse 18 and read through to the end of the chapter. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God, and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than humanity's strength. Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. It is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God. That is our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, the one who boasts, boast in the Lord. Now, in the extensive research that I did ahead of this evening, I came across and was utterly inspired by the work of Becky Martz. Has anyone come across Becky Martz? Becky Martz, a very famous presence on the internet, no? Becky Martz? I'm amazed. Well, Becky Martz, anybody like to hazard a guess at what Becky is famous for? Well, yes, she does blog. She does blog on her particular theme, on her particular expertise. She does blog. In fact, not only that, she actually holds a Sunday afternoon conversation. And as she's in America, you can even go home tonight probably and just about get her Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. It starts. Becky is the world's leading collector. Anybody Googled it yet? No. Aren't you all well behaved? I thought you'd all have your phones out by now. Becky is the world collector of banana labels. You know when you go to the supermarket and you buy bananas and they have a little label on saying who's made them? Becky has a collection of over 17,000 banana labels. Isn't that marvelous? Isn't that delightful for her? Becky is an authority. People write to her. Apparently, people send them to her. If you're interested in supporting Becky's work, can I just say that if you go onto her website, beckymart.com, you can also email her. She loves to have emails, apparently. I can't imagine why she needs friends. But she loves to have emails. And so if you go into Morrison's next door, anywhere like that, you see a label, you can actually check her website, see if she's already got it. And if she hasn't got it, you can send it to her as you carefully and lovingly peel it off your banana and send Becky your banana label. 17,000 banana. She's actually recently, as well as holding her Sunday afternoon conversations and other things, she's recently branched out, by the way. She very proudly announces on her website, if you look it up, she's recently branched out into broccoli labels. And not only that, but she also collects, I didn't even know these came customized, because where I come from, they just use elastic bands. But she's just also branched out into asparagus bands. You know, you get a little bunch of asparagus and it's sort of wrapped. Apparently they are especially. Becky Martz is well, she's one of a number of people. There are many other people whose work I could have introduced you to this evening. There's a gentleman in Herefordshire, I think it is, who's the proud owner of 10,000 different milk bottles. And you can visit his milk bottle museum and you can see them all. And then, of course, there's a famous chap who is an authority and collector of traffic cones. Apparently, there are over 500 different kinds of traffic cones. I think I've probably seen every one of them in my journeys around the northwest of England and North Wales. But yes, he collects traffic cones. In fact, 2 years ago, there was a special calendar came out. Strangely enough, it wasn't repeated for 2016. There wasn't the demand for some strange reason. But there was a calendar came out in 2015 of Britain's dullest men. One of whom was a roundabout spotter. Another was a hedge enthusiast. The milk bottle man made it in there, as did the traffic cone man. And so we can go on. But Becky Martz, to me, stood out. I don't know why, but I just thought collecting banana labels is just so inspiring. I'm sure there are people tonight who are going to go home and look at their bananas. When you are looking at your bananas and you are looking for the label, I want you to look in front of the mirror and say, how sad. Oh, look at that. There we go. There's a really sad person. She's actually got a banana out. Look at that. Yes. Send it to Becky. Now, what have you got? Have you got a label on it? Oh, let's just check. Anyone got a smartphone? Let's go for it. Let's go for it. Oh, that's an interesting label. Thank you so much for that. It's a Rainforest Alliance. Oh, I don't know whether that's a make, though. It's a Rainforest Alliance certified banana label. So if you go on Becky, have you got your smartphone there? Go on Becky's website, check under R, and see if we could send her this, couldn't we? With love from Penrach Baptist Church in Wales. She's probably never heard of North Wales. She comes from America. How are we doing? Can you check her website? Check under R and see if she's got a Rainforest Alliance certified. That's a bit green, that one. I wouldn't eat that tonight. Save that for tomorrow, because it needs to go a little bit more yellow yet. But there we go. So there you go. You're away now, aren't you? I just want to know, next time I come here, I'm going to find out how many of you have actually checked your banana labels and have been in touch. But of course, there are people, and I'm sure there are people in this room tonight, some of us who will have the most bizarre and strange passions and hobbies. Things that we would go to the ends of the earth for, that other people would never, ever understand why. Of course, if you're of a certain age, you don't have to go to the end of the earth to pursue your hobby, because you have parents who will do it for you. Reminds me of the story on one occasion. My son is a rock. No, he's not. He's a jazz drummer. And apparently there's a particular kind of cymbal that is not at its best. It's made, I think, by Zildjian. And it's not at its best for a jazz drummer until it has been in the possession of a rock drummer for 20 years. And after a rock drummer has beaten the living daylight out of this particular cymbal, it has a particular lovely resonance that jazz drummers like. And he found one. It cost him £5 on eBay, and it cost me £25 in fuel to drive to Buckinghamshire to collect it for him. But he's incredible. And I looked at this battered old cymbal and I said, I can't believe I've just travelled halfway across the UK for this thing. But for him, it makes all the difference. But I said, Mark, you've already got 300 cymbals. I haven't got 300 cymbals. You're exaggerating. All right, but you've got more than I can fit in my house. And you don't need a stand for... You do need a stand for all of them. Okay. And so it goes on. But we've all got our own particular habits and hobbies. I nearly said that. Hobbies. We all have the things that matter to us. And when something matters to us, when something is really important to us, then it's something that we will go to extraordinary lengths to pursue. I have my own. I've got to be honest. I remember on one occasion, I was with my colleagues, and some of you, have you ever been to Oxford? Obviously, on a missionary trip to the academic world, there's a particular Oxfam bookshop on the corner by where they have the fair there. And it's quite near to Regent's Park Baptist College. And whenever you're there, it's always the done thing to go to the, even if you don't really want to buy anything, it sort of looks good to go to the academic bookshop. But I was in there on one occasion. I got terribly excited because I managed to find a book. How cool is this? I managed to find a book that actually has the profile of every single railway ballast in the UK. And it shows you the shape. It shows you the shape that the Welsh coastline had. It shows you the shape of the ballast in the London, Midland, Scottish. And my colleagues said, well, why on earth would you want to buy that? I said, well, because if I'm ever making a model of either a Great Western Line or an LMS, I can get the ballast. Absolutely. Why wouldn't I want this wonderful, wonderful book? And it only cost me £2. I couldn't believe that they couldn't share the joy. I spent the whole evening looking at the different ballast shapes and realizing that in certain times the engineers used to sort of stack it up with this. Look at this guy, he's mesmerized. You can see a railway modeler a mile away. He's sitting up on the edge of his chair. Tell me more of this ballast. Was it granite? Well, it's all in there. It's all in there. It's fantastic stuff. But we've all got our own particular hobbies and habits, and those are the things that we will look at one another at, the extraordinary lengths we'll go to. But of course, as a Christian people, and this is the question that I want us to wrestle with tonight, I want to simply offer to us the question, where does Jesus fit into all that? You may remember if you were here this morning, I was really just trying to share my own heart and my own passion, which is to see us as a people reinvigorated and remobilized as a faith-sharing people, as a Jesus-sharing people, as a people who encourage and draw others into becoming followers of Jesus. And this morning we looked at the story of Jesus when he encountered this man who was riddled with leprosy. And as it were, we looked at Jesus from the inside out. We looked at how Jesus is welled with compassion for this man. And being welled with compassion, he reaches out and touches him. And because he is God, he is able to say, be clean, and he is clean. And it's almost, if you follow the dynamic, it was how Jesus was kind of lifted from in the state of compassion, of reaching out to the guy and beginning to say, well, how do we learn to be like that? How do we learn to be like that in our approach to the world around us? And what I want to try and do tonight is to flip the coin and say, well, yes, it's important that we are a people who have that same heart that God has for our world. But I also want us to kind of look a little bit at the external factors and to recognize we also need to be a people who have a confidence in the message that we share. A people who have a confidence in the message that we share. Now, we began our little exploration this evening by looking at two stories that Jesus told. Two stories of people who in different ways went to extreme lengths in order to achieve something. Now, they weren't banana label collectors or any other sort of strange habit, but they were people whose story makes sense. The one guy, we're told, Kingdom of Heaven, says Jesus is like a man who is digging in a field and finds treasure. And when he finds a treasure, he buries it again, he goes off, he buys the field, and we're told that under the particular law of the land at the time, that once he owned the field, he owned everything within it, the treasure would become his. And so we can understand the kind of story that Jesus is trying to tell, the picture that Jesus is trying to paint. And then he takes us across and looks at a very different scene. He said, the kingdom of heaven is also like a collector, like a banana label collector. But no, not a banana, a collector of pearls. And it's as though this collector of pearls suddenly finds a pearl that just stands out from every other one they've ever collected. And the rest of the collection is worth getting rid of for the sake of that one. And Jesus says the kingdom of heaven's like that. Now, what I want us to notice here is that these two people behave absolutely normally. Let's face it. If, you know, there are thousands of people today who, given the opportunity to make an investment that is going to make an even greater return, are going to do it. It makes sense. There are people of my generation that were told to do that with all kinds of things a few years ago, and we wish we hadn't. But nonetheless, we recognize the logic. Both of these people, they're not coerced. You know, it's not as if the guy who goes out and buys the field, his mum sort of gets someone, you know, it's about time you owned a field. You know, everyone else in the family owns a field. Why don't you get a field? Get a field, for goodness sake. Why won't you own a field? It doesn't happen like that. It happens because he makes a discovery. He makes a discovery, and he actually acts in a pretty self-interested way, if we're honest. But the thing is, the guy is convinced that what he's doing is worthwhile. He's convinced that what he's doing is worth the investment. And so he behaves in an absolutely normal way, as does the pearl collector. And I think that's the point that Jesus wants to get across here. When Jesus says to us, I want you to go into the world and to proclaim the good news. When Jesus says to us, I want you to join me in being proclaimers of this fantastic message of good news. I don't think he's trying to send us on a guilt trip. And I don't think he needs to send us on a guilt trip. You see, if we're convinced that something is good news, we don't need a lot of persuasion. I wonder, is there anybody here who are grandparents? Okay, quite a few of you. Now, I want you to go back to the moment. I know some of you aren't grandparents, but some of you have grandparents. But I want you to go back to the moment you discovered that you were a grandparent, okay? When the first one arrived. Now, how long did it take you before you rang someone to tell them? Did you sort of wait for a couple of weeks to let the information filter through? How many of you could produce a picture of one of your grandchildren now? Quite a few of you, yeah. You know, did part of the antenatal classes, was there a special class for grandparents? You know, dear grandparent, might be a good idea to let a few people know. So why don't you make a list of handy phone numbers so you can have them by the way? And if it's not too much trouble, once that EastEnders has finished or whatever's on at the time, yeah, maybe just ring a few people up. How long did it take you to share that news? Not very long, I suspect, because you were convinced it was good news. It made sense. You know, in the last church of which I was a member, we had a lovely, lovely lady in the congregation whose name was Teresa. I can tell you it now because she's passed on. But Teresa was a most amazing lady. She could have run a website, actually. She could have run her own if you'd have known how to do all the... Well, it wasn't around in Teresa's time. But she was an expert on women's meetings, to be honest. And she could tell you, she could feed a family of four on the women's meetings of East Surrey for an entire year. She knew all the women. She knew exactly who did what sandwiches and which women's rally had what refreshments and such like. And she would give a running commentary every Sunday telling people of a certain age, ladies of a certain age, in particular, were to go in the following week. And Teresa was one of the great people. She was just full of life, typical sort of East Ender kind of character. And one New Year's Eve, I was out in the shops. We lived in quite a small community, and the shops paraded, shops you met. You couldn't really go shopping. If I wanted to not be a Baptist minister for the day, I'd go shopping in Purley or somewhere like that, so I didn't meet anybody. But when you were shopping, you always met someone. And on this one occasion, I could see down the other end of the parade, there was Teresa and quite a crowd of people, and she was clearly attracting a lot of attention. Now, obviously, being a good, diligent Baptist minister, I immediately crossed the road and walked and went, no, I didn't. I walked right down and began to make my way towards her, but it wasn't any need because Teresa saw me. And as Teresa saw me, she came running towards me with immense enthusiasm. Phil, she said, Phil, you've got to go to the cake shop. Everything's reduced to 10p. And sure enough, it was New Year's Eve, and basically the person in charge of the cake shop said, right, let's get rid of all the stuff and clothes, put everything down to 10p. And she was there, and she's after half the community are queuing up at the cake shop because Teresa sent them all. You see, she had good news. She didn't need telling twice. She didn't need instructions. She was so confident in the message she had. She did the most natural thing on earth. And I want to suggest to you that that is the same confidence that we can have in this gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, the Apostle Paul, when he writes to the church in Corinth, these were people who were getting themselves worked up. It was funny, we were singing before about, I'm laying down my religion. And I don't know about you, when I saw that, I'd not heard that song before. Thank you for introducing it to me. But when I, you know, I'm laying down my religion, I work for them. But actually, I kind of got it. Because actually, that was exactly some of the stuff that Paul was getting his head round when he was right. This church at Corinth, they were getting themselves all worked up about who was who and which of the local preachers was best and were we like that one, were we like this one, were we think that one's better than that one, and all that kind of rubbish was going on. And Paul is just saying to them, look, for goodness sake, just focus on Jesus. Just focus on Jesus. And if Jesus is going to be the most important thing to us, if we're going to have the same passion for Jesus as dear old Becky Maritz has for banana labels, then we've got to become convinced of a few things. And the first thing is this, that we've got to have a confidence in Jesus. You see, it's fascinating. When Paul writes to the church in Philippi, he reflects for a huge amount of time on all his kind of religious credentials. He talks about the fact that he's had a brilliant education and he's got all kinds of well-known relatives and all the rest of it. And he says, you know, he said, all of that stuff, it's nothing compared to knowing Jesus. But the thing that we discover about Paul when we begin to read his story is that actually this isn't just a bit of sentiment. This isn't, well, that's the kind of thing you would say, wouldn't you, if you're an itinerant preacher and a church planter. He says it because he's realized it for himself. What I think we forget sometimes is that the guy who writes all this stuff in the New Testament, who writes letters like the letter to Corinthians that we read a few moments ago together, he is introduced to us in the story as frankly a religious terrorist. Someone who is persecuting the church. You know, the kind of thing we heard at the beginning of our service tonight is the kind of thing that early believers would have heard. And you know, the guy who was at the center of it was Paul. Saul, as he was known at that time. And this is the crazy thing, that his religious fervor, his obsession with his religion, had turned him into this thug, this terrorist, this guy who would stop at nothing to put down anybody who claimed that this Jesus that he found, whose message he found, made no sense to him at all at the time. He would stop at nothing. His obsession was to destroy the followers of Jesus, to the point where when he had run out of followers of Jesus to beat up and terrorize and lives to mess up in Jerusalem, and discovered that all the trouble he was creating for them in Jerusalem had simply set the church on fire in Damascus, metaphorically, not literally, he went to Damascus to try and do his bully boy stuff there. And it was on his way into Damascus that suddenly he realizes that his religion and his credentials and his knowledge and his understanding is of absolutely no value whatsoever because of one simple fact: he met Jesus. In fact, the story was so kind of mind-blowing, even if you read it in the book of Acts, there's a lot of detail that isn't really there because it's just so sudden. He has a blinding flash and the next thing he can't see and he hears a voice. And it's quite a garbled story in some respects. But what we know is it was real. Because years later, he's still telling the story. And time again, he finds himself in situations where, I mean, he's a clever guy. He knows his stuff. He knows his stuff inside out. But he will still say to people, do you know, all I can really say to you is that I know Jesus. I've met the living Jesus. It's not a set of theories. It's not a set of ideas. It's not even a set of rules and regulations or ought to's. In fact, I lived that kind of religion for years, and it did me no good whatsoever. But I've met Jesus. Now, what I find interesting about the two men in Jesus' story is, although, I mean, at one level, they've got this huge amount in common in that they both find something that is worth everything to them. At another level, they're complete opposites to one another. You see, the pearl collector is a kind of connoisseur, if you like. I mean, to be perfectly honest, if someone showed me a pearl and said, well, sell everything you've got and buy this, I probably wouldn't, because I don't know enough about pearls, and I don't particularly want to find out enough about pearls to know. But he did. He knew a good thing when he saw it. He was an expert. The guy with the field, well, I mean, he's just a bit of an opportunist, to be honest. He was not an expert in fields or treasure, but he kind of knew. He just stumbled across it one day. And you get the difference here, that these people almost represent two extremes, two ends of a spectrum. One who is the expert, the connoisseur, the person who knows his stuff. The other who is just an opportunist, who just stumbles across something. And I guess as we look around the room, if we all had a little time of one-to-ones at the moment, we'd say, well, do you know, actually, probably in this room tonight, there's a similar mix. Some of us are probably the kind of people, I mean, my two kids are like this. You know, my son is so analytical, it drives me bonkers at times. But you know, that some of us are like that. We like to get into all the facts. We like to get all the information. We like to know stuff. We like to work it out. And Jesus says, you know, there's space in my kingdom for people like that, because you could do all that working out. And you know what you find is that this thing is worth more than anything else. And others of us might say, you know, I really don't understand half of the stuff. I don't even understand what Phil's talking about tonight, to be honest. But I do know Jesus is real. I do know I've met him. And one of the biggest concerns that I have is that sometimes we buy into this idea that that's not enough. And actually, that's the idea that the Corinthian church had bought into. If you read the bit before, Paul says what I've just read out. They were all falling out with each other because they, oh, it's not enough. You've got to know the right person. You've got to be a follower of Peter. You've got to be a follower of Paul or Apollos or whoever. And Paul's kind of saying, will you just back off? And will you just recognize that actually it's enough to know Jesus? And we need a confidence in that. We need a confidence in that. And if you know Jesus, if you've met Jesus, then what I want to say to you is everything you've heard about him is worth it. Everything you've heard about him is worth knowing, is worth talking about, is worth sharing. So the first thing that we need to be is a people who have a confidence in Christ. And the second thing, it seems to me, is we need to be a people who have a confidence in the gospel. This is what Paul is saying. We preach Christ crucified. And the thing, that, again, the reason Paul has got a confidence in the gospel, it's because Paul has experienced the impact of the gospel. Paul was a no-hoper. I don't think Paul was very high, Saul as he was then known, on the church's prayer list or expected convert list. I don't think anybody was expecting him to turn up at their church. Well, they were expecting him to turn up at their church, but not for the reasons that he did. God changed him. God transformed him. You know, if you read the first few chapters of the Acts of the Apostles, you probably, you know, the most unlikely person to become the pillar of this church was going to be Saul, but God transformed him. And we live in a world today, and we've heard about some of those things, and we prayed about some of those things tonight, where we encounter people, we encounter situations that look hopeless, that we, in our human understanding of things, we couldn't imagine ever being different. But the message of the gospel, time and time and time again, is this is a gospel that transforms people, that transforms situations, that transforms communities. This is a gospel that can make things different. And the great thing is this, that this gospel is not bound by our ability to explain it. It's not bound by our ability to somehow get it out there. God was perfectly capable of getting hold of Paul, Saul, on his way to Damascus without our help. But it did take a man called Ananias to have the wisdom and the faith to recognize the transformation that God was working to bring him to the place where he could be integrated and accepted and become the great leader that he did. And again, I want to encourage us to be a people who have a confidence in this gospel. That when we look at the world around us today, when we see situations, when we hear people, when we encounter things and we say, you know, where have people got any room for God anymore? To say this gospel has power. And so this morning, I wanted us to kind of look at the internal, if you like, message of Jesus. How we need to have a compassion that reaches out. And tonight, what I want to recognize is the external. These two people, the pearl collector and the field digger, they came across a set of external circumstances where the most natural thing in the world was to make this one thing central. And so I want to ask you a question tonight. What is the most important thing in your life? What is the most important thing in your life? And I want to ask you that question not on the basis of trying to put you on a guilt trip, not on the basis of trying to be a kind of judgmental preacher, because again, the point, as I've said already, is that if you believe in something, the most natural thing in the world is to make it central, whether that's banana label collecting or whether it's Jesus. And if you, as you reflect on that question, say, well, actually, no, I'm not sure that it is this Jesus and this gospel that is absolutely defining me, then I would simply invite you not to go on a guilt trip, but just to simply pray, Lord Jesus, help me to know you more. Help me to have that encounter with you, that it becomes the most natural thing in the world to want others to have it too. Give me that confidence. Let me see. Let me re-see. Open me. Let me hear the stories. That's why I think it's so important we live our faith in community, that we journey together. Let me see the transformation that your gospel has made, that I may have and build that faith that this gospel can transform other things too. We preach Christ crucified, says Paul. It doesn't make sense to the logic seekers. It doesn't make sense to the power hungry. But it makes perfect sense to those who have encountered Jesus, to those who have been changed by Jesus, and those who believe that others can be changed by Jesus too. And if we really believe that, if we really believe that, then sharing that gospel will be as natural as telling people about half-price cakes, telling people about grandchildren or nieces or nephews, telling people that we passed our exams, telling people that we've got our place at our favorite uni or whatever else it may be. Not because anyone's told us we should, but because we recognize that we can't help but do anything else. May God help us all to have a confidence and an encounter with that gospel that has that impact on our lives too. Amen.